Thank you, Liz, and good morning, Chair Imason, State Forester Doherty, and members of the board. For the record, my name is Cindy Kolomaychuk, and I am the project manager for the Western Oregon HCP for the State Forest Division. Before I go into the process, I just wanted to also acknowledge our consultants that played a huge role in our success of reaching this milestone today. We had a number of folks from ICF, and they provided the technical consulting expertise that we needed to get through the draft HCP. We also have Echo Northwest, that is Mark Buckley, who worked on the comparative analysis. And so he is also the one that did the original business case analysis. And so very quickly, I would like to run through these names. Dr. David Zippin is the vice president of ICF. He provided overall direction for that technical team. Troy Ramig, who you have heard from before and will hear more from today, was really the linchpin in getting this work all put together. He's the project manager for ICF. Melissa Klungel is the senior biologist aquatics lead. Dr. Aaron Gabby, he's a senior biologist and terrestrial lead. So they helped with the conservation strategies that are in the draft HCP. And Erica Brittany is with ICF, but was really helpful in developing the comparative analysis that you'll see today. Also, Dr. Greg Lotta, which some of you might be familiar with, he is at the University of Idaho and really helped with our modeling. In addition to this technical work, we have had a lot of meetings with the steering committee and the scoping team, as well as the counties and our stakeholders. And so we needed some help with this. And so we hired a team of professional consultants to assist. We worked with Kearns and West, so with Deb Noodleman, she was the primary facilitator. Sylvia Chiborowski, also a facilitator and just an excellent associate that helped us keep on track with all of our minutes. And all of you have probably seen those minutes and agendas that are on our website. Michelle Bardini helped us keep track of all of our notes. And many of you also know Brett Brownscombe. He's joining us today with Oregon Consensus. He's the senior project manager for Oregon Consensus. And Brett really pushes us around the edges on stakeholder engagement and also helps us develop relationships with new stakeholders, which I think you'll see today that we've really broadened the tent in terms of stakeholders. And then, of course, myself, I'm the project manager. So if you'll go forward. Today, we are going to cover a number of topics. First, I'll go over really quickly the process update, which State Forester Doherty and Liz Dent have also covered a little bit today. And then we'll go over the draft HCP key concepts. So we're really focusing on those that you have not heard too much about to date. So there's a lot in that draft HCP. So we're sort of starting where we left off in July. We'll work with the effects analysis, the conservation strategies, so an update there, what our monitoring strategy will be, and the cost and funding, so how we are going to afford to implement the HCP. And then, as Liz mentioned, we'll get into the comparative analysis and then stakeholder and county engagement. So as you have heard, we have put a lot of work into the draft HCP with our consultants and our sister state and federal agencies. And so you'll see by those blue arrows there, those are the chapters of the HCP we've been focused on. And they really are the foundational chapters of the HCP, as well as those that have conservation and economic outcomes. And the reason we focused on these is because we believe that this is the information that you need in order to make the decision on whether or not it's in the best interest of the state to move forward with the HCP and move into NEPA process. If so directed, as Liz mentioned, we would continue to refine the draft HCP, so you'll see that in that dark green arrow. And the plan would be to begin the NEPA process in early spring of 2021. At the same time, we would be developing the companion forest management plan, and we would bring both fully vetted plans back to you in June of 2022. So that is an HCP that has been through the NEPA process, as well as the companion FMP that has gone through stakeholder engagement, as well as the rulemaking process. So with that, I think I'll just take a moment and cue up Troy and Nick and Mike, who are going to be going over the draft HCP.
Thanks, Cindy. Chair Imason, State Forester Doherty, and the members of the board, my name is Troy Ramick. I'm with ICF. And as Cindy noted, I'm the project manager for the technical team that's been supporting the HCP effort. Over the next several minutes here, myself, Nick Palazzotto, and Mike Wilson are going to give you an overview of some of the emerging sort of technical details that you haven't seen yet. I'm going to provide a little bit of a setup for that work here initially, and also going to take us back a little bit and just remind you all and remind those that are watching of some of the fundamental elements of the HCP that we've been talking about for a while. Next slide. So first and foremost, you've seen this before, but a reminder that the HCP covers all of the ODF managed lands west of the Cascades, and showing on the map here in green is where the HCP will apply. This is what we term the permit area, where the permits would apply. And next slide. And I think also, as you'll hear about a little bit later in the technical presentation and also as part of the comparative analysis, we sometimes summarize information in terms of sub-geographical areas, as shown on this slide, in terms of the North Coast, the Willamette Valley, and the South Coast. So those terms might come up in presentations later today. Next slide. One of the other fundamental elements of the HCP is the covered species. You've seen this list before. A reminder that ultimately the HCP supports an application to NOAA Fisheries and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for permits under the Endangered Species Act for species. And so the species that are covered in the HCP become a sort of a fundamental element and an organizing principle. This list of 16 species hasn't changed in a while. You've seen this before. There are 9 fish species, 7 wildlife species. The only notable change to this list, actually, since we talked last, is that the coastal marten, which up until now or previously was not listed, has actually now been proposed to be listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act. And a reminder that there are a few other species on this list noted with asterisks, and they are currently not listed, but may be listed in the future. And one of the inherent benefits of the HCP and sort of the insurance policy, if you will, going forward, is that those species that are not currently listed but may become listed in the future can be included as covered species, and then their conservation needs will already be addressed into the future. Next slide. So the purpose of the HCP, we're all experts on this by now, but I thought it was worth repeating, is of course to avoid, minimize, and mitigate impacts, the impact of taking on federally listed species or those that may be listed in the future. I noted that it will result in permits under the Endangered Species Act from both federal agencies, because there are species that are under the jurisdiction of each of the federal agencies. We're proposing a 70-year permit term, so the permits would apply for 70 years, and so a lot of the materials that you've seen, both the HCP and the comparative analysis, contemplate that 70-year permit term as part of the work. And importantly, what we're striving for here with the HCP is to create certainty in operations over the course of that period of time, but also to create certainty in the quality and quantity of conservation outcomes during that period of time. So really certainty on all sides of the equation over that permit term. And then I think a new thing that you're going to hear more about today is that the HCP also establishes by necessity a monitoring and adaptive management program that really is charged with tracking how the HCP is performing over time. Are we meeting the objectives that are set in the HCP? And so we'll hear more about that today. And then lastly, and probably most importantly, a no surprises assurances in that, sometimes noted as a deal is a deal. So the terms of the HCP and the permits that are associated with it eventually are then, locked in for that 70-year permit term. And that's where the operational certainty comes in, because there will be no expectation of new, regulatory requirements on the department, at least for those covered species in the future, and allows ODF to then manage the forest with much more certainty over time. Next slide. So really quickly here, just a bit of a thumbnail sketch of what is in the HCP. Many of you have now seen the draft of the document that's been made available on the website. And some of these elements, which again are sort of fundamental to the HCP, you've seen before, others are new, you're gonna hear about today. But if you've been reviewing the materials, you have seen these things mostly manifesting in terms of individual chapters of the HCP. So of course there are the covered activities, the forest management related activities that will be included in the HCP, the species which we just mentioned, Today, you're going to hear more about the conservation strategies that have been developed to avoid, minimize, and mitigate take of species from the covered activities, and then the effects analysis that really summarizes that intersection when you put covered activities on the landscape in species habitat, what happens, and we describe that in the HCP, and then, of course, I mentioned the monitoring and adaptive management program. We also spend some time in the draft talking about what implementation of the HCP will look like. So there's an entire chapter devoted to that. And then an important required element of any HCP is that everything that is described, we develop a cost for those elements and then describe how it will all be funded over time. So you'll see that described in the draft as well. Next slide. In a minute, I'm going to turn it over to Nick Palazzotto and Mike Wilson, who are going to dive more deeply into the effects analysis and conservation strategies for our covered species. But I thought I would set you up with just a little bit of a thumbnail sketch of what that looks like, so you can be listening for these things as we go along for the rest of the morning here, and also just to give you a little bit of an umbrella idea of really what is in the HCP. When you boil it down, we sort of have an aquatic conservation strategy and a terrestrial conservation strategy. For the aquatic conservation strategy, the centerpiece of that strategy is riparian conservation areas, which is a riparian buffering strategy that we've developed to address some of the key sort of ecosystem drivers for our aquatic species, namely fish species, but also the torrent salamander species, which are aquatic. In addition to the riparian conservation areas or the riparian buffering strategy, you'll see in that draft a couple of conservation actions that are devoted to road system management, management of the existing road system, and also contemplating additional roads being built in the future. There also is some discussion in the draft conservation strategy about stream enhancement activities and some commitments to what stream enhancement might look like into the future. That's both, of course, wood enhancement and also more traditional aquatic restoration activities, including removal of barriers in the stream network to increase access to habitat by our covered fish species. On the terrestrial side, the centerpiece for the terrestrial conservation strategy is really the habitat conservation areas. These are areas that are designated on the landscape that would be managed for the benefit of species habitat over time. So you'll see a description in there, and Nick will talk about more about that in a minute. There are more traditional elements that you've seen before, retention commitments in terms of what will happen outside of those habitat conservation areas, leave tree strategies, downed wood strategies, et cetera, some things that you're probably more commonly familiar with. And then also contemplating the need for some more strategic species actions in the future. You'll see a conservation action in there devoted to activities that will release other stressors that we know around the landscape on our cover species, things like barred owl removal, for example, and others that are described. In order to pay for those, remember we have to establish how funding will occur or how funding will be assured for those covered activities in the conservation strategies. We talk about the establishment of a conservation fund that is described in the conservation strategy chapter, but then described in more detail in the cost and funding chapter, if you've had a chance to look at that. And that will be then dedicated funding that will be used for implementation of those conservation strategies over the course of the permit term. So with that, I think next slide, I'm going to then turn it over to Nick Palazzotto, who is going to spend more time on the terrestrial conservation strategy.
Thanks, Troy. Good morning, Chair Imeson, State Forester Doherty, members of the board. For the record, my name is Nick Palazzotto, State Forests Wildlife Biologist, and today I'll be providing you with a brief overview of our conservation strategy for terrestrial species. Next slide. As Troy mentioned, we conducted an effects analysis for each species. The analysis examined whether covered activities would cause direct mortality to known locations of covered species, such as nest sites or core breeding areas. We also looked at whether and how they might result in loss of suitable and highly suitable habitat over time, and potential indirect effects, such as increased predation risk over the long term. We determined that effects could be largely minimized and to a lesser extent mitigated through a series of conservation actions applied across various spatial scales and over the planned term. Next slide. The primary action taken to address effects on covered species and meet the biological goals and objectives for each is the establishment of habitat conservation areas, or HCAs for short. And in designing the HCAs, we prioritized for inclusion the areas where species are known to occur from current or historic survey data, areas where suitable or highly suitable habitat occurs, or where the habitat models, which are built on our stand level inventory, show high potential for habitat development over time. We also consider broader habitat connectivity on the landscape. And for spotted owls and marbled murrelets, the current design incorporates the vast majority of suitable and highly suitable habitat in the permit area now, and nearly all known species occurrences. Occurrence data for red tree voles, Oregon slender salamanders, and coastal marten are more limited and habitat requirements a little broader, but the HCAs still provide the bulk of the conservation lift for these species. Next slide. Moving on now to the size and distribution of habitat conservation areas. At the permit area level, about 275,000 acres, or 43% of state forests, are in HCAs. The breakdown is similar at the subregion level, with about 43% in HCAs on the North Coast, 40% in the Willamette Valley subregion, and 47% in Southern Oregon. The higher proportion in the South is a function of higher densities of active spotted owl sites in that region. And this figure shows that breakdown by size classes and subregions, with the size classes for the HCAs on the x-axis, the number of HCAs on the y-axis, and the subregions shown as the colored proportions of each bar. There are over 200 HCAs, and they range in size from less than 50,000 acres to more than 50,000 acres. And about half fall within the 100 to 500 acre range. There's about 26 that are less than 50 acres. Those are shown on the far left here. And four that are more than 10,000 acres. Those are shown on the far right. And this wide range is a function of two primary factors. Species occurrence and habitat data largely drove where HCAs are located, but ownership patterns also influence their size. On the North Coast, where we have a relatively large land base and extensive survey history, there are several large HCAs, including the four largest. On parts of these and other districts where parcels are smaller, the HCAs are too. Next slide. And you can see those patterns in size and shape on the maps that were submitted as part of the board materials. But I show the North Coast here as an example because all of those size classes are present. And so large HCAs are visible on the west side of the forest in green and moving east to west across the forest. Other HCAs, 1,000 acres or larger, are visible on Astoria, on scattered blocks in eastern Forest Grove and southern Tillamook. And then there are several smaller HCAs visible in the small scattered parcels on the southern end of the forest and in southwest Clatsop County. Next slide, please. We're proposing to conduct management activities in HCAs to increase the quantity and quality of habitat over time. Efforts would focus primarily on stands under 80 years old and dense plantations with simple structure, and also on conifer restoration in alder-dominated stands or areas with moderate to severe Swiss needlecast infestations. Management activities would occur primarily within the first 30 years of the permit term to allow for habitat development within the 70-year term. We're still refining the annual targets and flexibility around those targets. More than a third of the acres in HCAs are either inoperable or in inner gorges or riparian conservation areas. No management is proposed in these areas. Another third or so are in existing T&E sites and other high-quality habitat for the covered species. We're not proposing management activities in these areas either. Management activities to increase habitat would occur on the remaining acres, which are just under a third of the total acres in the HCAs. Next slide, please. Okay, so for four of the covered species, we developed habitat suitability indices built on our stand level inventory data. And this enabled us to bring those habitat models into the forest management model, and thus we can project habitat growth and harvest over the permit term. Here we show the modeled habitat outcomes for spotted owls in the figure on top and marbled murrelets down below. The blue proportions of each bar show cumulative growth of habitat inside the HCAs over the permit term. The red portions are habitat growth outside the HCAs, and the green bars show cumulative harvest of habitat based on model estimates. Habitat that's harvested outside of the HCAs occurs under the incidental take permit, which provides for this flexibility to allow these stands to grow and still be harvested subsequently. Total growth estimates exceed targets set in the HCP under the biological goals and objectives because the targets are enough to offset harvest effects, and there's always some uncertainty around habitat development relative to a modeled estimate. Next slide, please. The HCAs are really the centerpiece of a broader strategy intended to provide for a functional landscape for covered species. Other actions designed to support and augment the HCAs are also part of the overall approach. We include a number of actions intended to minimize effects on known species locations through seasonal and other restrictions. The nature of restrictions vary by species and by location, depending on whether inside or outside of the HCAs and proximity to occupied or suitable habitat inside the HCAs. We also use the conservation fund that Troy referenced for some specific activities in HCAs or in support of the covered species in other ways. For example, reforestation activities in HCAs might utilize the fund to cover any cost increases associated with alternative approaches to young stand management. Barred owl management activities and other targeted species conservation actions would be funded and might include contribution to captive breeding and reintroduction programs, or research to improve understanding of species and habitat management. Funding would also be used to address new population stressors as they arise. And many of the conservation and management actions both inside and outside of the HCAs would be tied to a monitoring program. Next slide. And as Mark will highlight in the comparative analysis, one of the benefits of a formal monitoring program under an HCP is a shift away from an operational or timber sale-based approach to species surveys to one that is focused on species and habitat goals. Monitoring components include a focus on changes in habitat quality over time compared to modeled estimates, including habitat lost to covered activities and habitat gained through growth, with reporting in 5-year intervals. Monitoring of current suitable habitat and species occurrence, and of species response to newly suitable habitat over time, and monitoring of silvicultural actions in HCAs to manage prescriptions and associated pace and scale. Many of these actions would then be tied into the broader adaptive management program under the companion FMP and the related implementation plan and structured decision-making processes. And now I will turn it over to Mike to discuss the riparian strategies.
Thank you, Nick. Chair Imeson, State Forester Doherty, members of the board, for the record, my name is Michael Wilson. I am the Resource Support Unit Manager for the State Forest Division. Similar to Nick's description of the effects of analysis for terrestrial species, the aquatic effects analysis will address impacts of covered activities to both fish and Columbian Cascade Torrent Salamanders, balanced against the protection and benefits of the conservation actions. For fish, The analysis unit will be the by independent population for each evolutionarily significant unit for each covered species. The focus for both fish and torrent salamanders will be how the covered activities may cause direct mortality to individuals of the species, inhibit the recruitment of large wood into the aquatic system, increase potential stream temperatures in fish-bearing portions of streams, and increase sediment delivery into the stream network. The effects analysis will address how the conservation actions are expected to minimize and mitigate the potential negative effects to the covered species. As we presented in July, here are the specifics of the riparian conservation area widths as they relate to stream classifications. There has been a minor change since you last saw these. Previously, the seasonal type F stream buffer was 50 feet because that particular stream type is not especially important for wood recruitment and is not subject to the stream temperature issues during the summer. So the effects to the covered species is expected to be minimal or non-existent. However, the Forest Practices Act would mandate a larger buffer based on the presence of fish that are not covered under the HCP. In their review of the strategy, field staff expressed that it would be operationally more efficient to apply one set of standards, so the buffer was increased to 120 feet to match the perennial type F streams. Seasonal type F streams are infrequent on our landscape, so this change has a minimal effect overall. Beyond RCAs, there will be benefits to covered fish through aquatic enhancement projects. A dedicated conservation fund will help ensure that these projects can be carried out consistently over time, regardless of market conditions or budgetary issues. While there will still be in-kind work included in the project work of adjacent management activities, larger projects or projects that don't have nearby operations to support them will utilize the conservation fund. These conservation projects will focus on limiting factors within each ESU and the criteria outlined in Chapter 4 of the HCP. They include projects from smaller wood, large wood enhancement projects and barrier removals to fully vacating legacy roads and large floodplain reconnection projects. Monitoring of both the implementation and effects of conservation actions will leverage and expand current programs such as ODFW's Aquatic Inventory Program. The AIP has been a very successful program that collects data and determines trends in many limiting factors, and we look forward to helping it continue. Over time, we expect to see an improvement in riparian and aquatic conditions through the RCA strategy. While stand age is a core surrogate for finer scale riparian habitat attributes, the general trend towards older forest will support the development of larger trees that will provide shade and large wood inputs to streams, thereby supporting the biological goals and objectives of the HCP. The inclusion of almost half of the RCAs within HCAs will provide further benefits, as generally less intensive management in upland areas will reduce thermal loading and overall summer low flows. The RCAs and HCAs combined provide significant conservation benefits to the species covered under the HCP. While the bulk of these acres are dedicated to conservation on the North Coast, the relative balance is similar across the three geographic areas as we see here. Taking in context of what Nick was mentioning about HCAs earlier, in that Southern Oregon has more owls than per acre than the rest of our ownership. Before we take a look at monitoring and adaptive management, I would like to go over the reporting cycle for the HCP. Reporting will have a different focus depending on whether it is annual, decadal, or a five-year midpoint check-in. Annual reporting will focus on compliance reporting, such as acres of suitable habitat harvested outside of HCAs, habitat enhancement within HCAs, or new road construction or vacating within RCAs and HCAs. The results of monitoring surveys for covered species and conservation fund projects and expenditures would also be reported annually. A comprehensive review will take place every 10 years in preparation for the next implementation plan cycle. Results of terrestrial species habitat loss and gain and the results of effectiveness monitoring will inform the next decade of harvest outside of HCAs and enhancement within HCAs. planning for restoration activities, and adjustments to the monitoring plan. A midpoint check-in every 5 years will summarize all annual reporting items and provide an update on terrestrial species habitat gain or loss. This will allow for operational adjustments to ensure that covered activities remain within implementation plan targets. As mentioned earlier, effectiveness monitoring for covered fish species will focus on limiting factors, and for terrestrial fish species will focus on the growth of habitat and species response to that habitat, especially as a response to enhancement activities within HCAs. Adaptive management under the HCP will establish triggers based on monitoring to identify the need for adjustment to conservation actions. These may involve both policy and operational changes to most effectively meet these objectives. For instance, forest structure response to habitat enhancement activities will likely result in operational adjustments to prescriptions over time. And the overall success of those treatments may result in changes to the allowable number of acres treated per year. Adaptive management under the HCP will also be responsive to new and improved methods for measuring forest structure, habitat, and species occurrence. For example, acoustical monitoring of covered species versus current survey methods and forest inventory methods involving metrics derived from LIDAR will help determine trends and also help rebalance as we move forward. The adaptive management cycle will generally be timed to match a 10-year implementation plan cycle, where the results of monitoring can inform the upcoming implementation plan. Smaller scale refinements, primarily operational adjustments, may be made annually or as the need for changes become apparent. Adaptation to climate change will involve many factors that are important to, but beyond the scope of, the conservation actions of the HCP specifically. Understanding those needs will require coordination and collaboration with other state and federal agencies. The cost and funding chapter of the HCP details ODF's costs related to the HCP directly and provides assurances to the services that there is sufficient funding for HCP implementation. The key cost centers for the HCP are HCP administration and staffing, including budgetary planning and reporting capacity and technical advice to field staff to implement activities, implementation of key restoration and enhancement activities, the monitoring and adaptive management program, and potential remedial measures for changed circumstances. It is important to note that the HCP cost and funding assurance is specific to the HCP and is not intended to cover all of the cost centers associated with state forests. With that, we would like to pause for questions on the HCP components.
This is Joe. I do have a clarifying, just a little, what it would like a little bit more color on something. You talked about in your beginning of the slides, the third of the acres basically reserved for non-operable, and a third of the acres for potential area or known species and high quality habitat. Could you go back to that slide? Yeah, that's the one. You talked about existing T&E sites and high quality habitat, a third. What is that breakdown? Do you know how many of the fall into high quality habitat and how much falls into T&E sites?
You know, I don't recall the specific numbers offhand. I want to say it's like half and half. Do you remember the number of acres in occupied sites?
I don't remember offhand.
But it's in the chapter. It's broken down in the chapter. I just don't have the specifics on hand. Wait a sec. No, I don't. I'd give you the wrong number. I'm going to refer to the chapter, Joe.
Okay, and then you talked about these third inoperable intergorges and such. I'm assuming there's protected intergorges outside of the HCAs that would not be harvested also. And also, it was my understanding you didn't have a great inventory of those intergorges and operable areas that we talked about last time. Do we have a better inventory of those?
We do. All of our harvest units for the modeling effort are classified as to whether or not they are operable or not. And then we have an estimate that we've had for quite some time of the intergorge areas that are from a digital elevation model analysis. So in that case, we know where the harvest units are. where the intergorges are may be a little bit fuzzy, but we believe it is an overall good overall estimate of the amount of encumbrance that we have associated with intergorges. And they are included in the modeling as well.
And I can assume the modeling to arrive at the harvest planning in the areas outside the HCA is considered inoperable areas. I would assume there's some inoperable areas within those that landscape also.
Yes, there are inoperable areas both inside and outside of HCAs.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Okay, well, if we don't have any other questions, I guess we can move on to the next section.
So, Tom, we're ahead of schedule, but we were scheduled for a stretch break after the HCP. So would you like to take that now?
Sure. That'll help us sync with the schedule. So why don't we do that? And then we come back in 15 minutes. Is that right?
Correct. So that would put us back here at 10:15, according. Yeah, 10:15.
Okay. We'll resume at 10:15. Thanks.
Thank you.